Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We'll have the news for you at the bottom of the hour, but first, it's Christmas Eve.
Hark the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King.
With peace come joy and gladness. The gloom of the war years fades as once more we light the national community Christmas tree.
That's President Harry Truman on Christmas Eve, 1945. Lighting the nation's Christmas tree was a signal to Americans everywhere that they too could light their trees after the three dark years of World War II. At the time, thousands of GIs were clogging railroad stations, bus terminals, and airports as the military scrambled to get them home for the holidays. Just as there are today with the nation fighting two wars, in 1945, thousands of U.S. troops were also still overseas. They tuned in to a special holiday program starring Judy Garland, Bing Crosby, and Bob Hope.
And now for all you men in the armed forces who happen to be 13-year-old girls, we bring you your one and only singing favorite, the first atom ever split, Frank Sinatra.
Here at home, churches were packed, people reached out to wounded veterans, and newspapers connected everyone with stories of holiday cheer. Matthew Litt collects some of these stories in Christmas 1945, the story of the greatest celebration in American history. He joins us, and Matt, this is really a story of all the wartime holidays, so let's start with 1941. It's just weeks after Pearl Harbor, and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill comes secretly to Washington, D.C. to meet with President Franklin Roosevelt, and he delivers a Christmas Eve message to the American people.
Let the children have their night of fun and laughter. Let the gifts of Father Christmas delight their play. Let us grown-ups share to the full in their unstinted pleasures before we turn again to the stern task and the formidable years that lie before us.
With hindsight, we understand the formidable tasks and the sacrifice that Churchill was referring to, but you can just put yourself in the living room of Americans in 1941, and at that point, they still had no idea what this war would require of them and the sacrifice it would take from them and from their sons and from their husbands and fathers and their families and communities.
And that really started to become apparent in 1942. You quote from an editorial written by a 10th grader named Peggy Duffy from Williamsburg, Virginia, and she's urging her neighbors to fake the holiday spirit for the sake of the boys fighting and dying overseas.
It's a beautiful piece, but it's unfortunate that it had to be written. And here's what Peggy wrote. Many of these boys may never live to know and feel the Christmas spirit. Many, though, will live to tell their children and grandchildren about the war they fought for freedom in America. For these reasons, we should have more Christmas spirit for these boys who were fighting so that America may remain free. Their mothers and dads feel very badly now and probably won't enjoy Christmas as they would if their sons were home.
That's pretty sophisticated stuff for a 10th grader.
And it's an unfortunate outgrowth of having your fathers and brothers go away to war. I think it makes you grow up a little faster than you otherwise would have.
So the war drags on. President Roosevelt speaks to the American people on the eve of Christmas 1943, and it's a stark message warning about the terrible fight yet to come.
The war is now reaching the stage where we shall all have to look forward to large casualty lists, dead, wounded, and missing.
By this point, there were 4 million American men and women overseas as part of the war effort. And Matt, there's a letter from a young girl to Santa in 1943. Can you read it?
Sure. Dear Santa, this year I don't need sleds and skates and dolls and games and things, for my daddy has just sent me a pair of silver wings. He's far away this Christmas in a land across the sea, so just bring me a war bond that will bring him back to me.
I'll be home for Christmas. You can plan on me. Please have snow mistletoe and presents on the tree.
Well, let's get to Christmas 1945 now. That's what your book is centrally about. The war is over, but there are still thousands of Americans overseas who couldn't get home for Christmas.
The United States Army and Navy did everything they could to give the men and women as close to a hometown Christmas as possible. And then with just an amazing spirit, the United States Army and Navy, the men and women, went ahead and tried to give the children in whatever country they found themselves in a Merry Christmas. Even those who were stationed in Germany and even those who were stationed in Japan, they turned around and gave some of what they had been fortunate enough to receive and gave it to those children to try to see to it that they could have a happy holiday.
There was also entertainment for troops overseas still. Those in Germany, Japan, and England, performers did as they did throughout the war. They did their best to entertain. Bob Hope was the host for a special radio program that was broadcast to those troops Christmas Day 1945.
Hear that? The bells of Christmas 1945 ring out clear and free around the world to you. Listen to them. Their message comes from the hearts of 132 million grateful Americans. Peace on earth, goodwill to men. And Merry Christmas to all of you.
But on the home front, tell us about the effort to get thousands of GIs home for the holiday.
Well, the United States Army and Navy had the best of intentions, and they tried to process as many men and women as they could so that they could get home for the holiday. This caused the greatest travel jam in American history. And many of the great stories from this period revolve around towns who were forced to come together on a very impromptu basis to give Christmas to troops who thought they would be home but just didn't make it. There's this trainload of Navy veterans who were going to Boston and to Buffalo. They were to stop in Glenwood Springs for about an hour, just on a stop over Glenwood Springs, Colorado. And the station master received a telegram stating that this trainload of troops were going to come in on Christmas Day. And all that was required of the station master was to tidy up his station. That's all it meant. But instead, he spoke to a friend of his and lamented, "Oh, it's terrible that these boys aren't going to get a real Christmas." Before you know it, the whole town is doing everything they can over Christmas Eve to put together a proper Christmas dinner for this trainload of veterans. And it just erupted into this amazing scene where these hundreds of Navy boys got a hot Christmas dinner when they never, ever thought they would.
It's a heartwarming story, and you have several of them in your book as these GIs try to get home for the holidays, one guy paying a cab driver hundreds of dollars to take him home because he couldn't get on any other transportation. Plus, there were a lot of snowstorms just by chance at that time of year, and kept a lot of service members far from home.
And there are stories of taxi cabs going from Los Angeles as far as Manhattan to try to get troops home. And when that didn't work, there were stories of local chambers of commerce who got together, chartered a plane, and sent the plane out to Los Angeles to bring their boys back to them.
It came upon a midnight clear, that glorious song of old, from
we started this conversation with President Truman on Christmas Eve at the White House. The next morning, Christmas Day, he traveled to Independence, Missouri, his hometown, to spend Christmas with his family. Tell us about that trip.
President Truman had missed one Christmas dinner with his mother in his entire life, and that's when President Truman himself was serving in World War I. And he had promised her that he would never, ever miss another dinner with her. So he was intent on going, and he did. He ultimately had Christmas dinner with his mother. It was a little rushed. He made it back in time to have Christmas with his family, with his wife and daughter and his extended family in Independence. And he needed it. He was, at heart, a small-town man, and he needed to get back to Independence and have Christmas there.
Finally, Matt, is there one story, one incident from Christmas 1945 that we haven't talked about yet that just sticks with you?
There was a young boy named Ronnie. And back in 1942, his dog passed away. He was 5 years old and his dog passed away. His parents couldn't bring themselves to tell him that his dog had passed away. So they came up with an idea. They said, why don't we just tell Ronnie that we sent his dog to the canine corps to go off and fight in Europe in World War II? and by the time the war is over, he'll have forgotten all about him. So 1945 comes around, the war ends. And Ronnie's watching television and radio news feeds about canine corps dogs coming home to their owners. And he's wondering where his dog is. So he writes a letter to the United States Army saying, you know, I'm a young boy, 8 years old. I sent my dog, Laddie, off to fight in the war in 1942. I don't know where he is. So the United States Army calls Ronnie's home and asks to speak to his mother. And the Army's apologizing up and down. We're terribly sorry. We don't know what happened to the dog. We have no record of this dog entering the canine corps. And Ronnie's mother, of course, was embarrassed and said, no, let me apologize to you. And the United States Army, as if the United States Army didn't have enough to do at Christmas 1945, they put a letter together to Ronnie saying, we regret to inform you that your dog passed away in the service of his country. And the war could not have been won without sacrifices from the canine corps and from dogs just like yours. Thank you very much. And all throughout Christmas, Ronnie was showing the letter to everyone he could, talking about what a hero his dog had been. Not only that, word of this story spread throughout the country, and there were letters now pouring in throughout the country coming to Ronnie from people across the country saying, playing along with the ruse, saying, thank you so much, Ronnie. We appreciate everything your dog did for the war and for America. He's a real hero.
Did he ever get another dog?
He did get another dog from a stranger who had written a letter telling him what a hero his first dog had been.
Kiss me once, then kiss me twice, then kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time.
Matthew Litt's book is Christmas 1945, the story of the greatest celebration in American history. And we've also been hearing your stories about that Christmas. One involves this song, It's Been a Long, Long Time. Here's Ralph Whitehead, Jr. of Amherst, Massachusetts.
For years and years, my mom has played this song on her piano, and she's been playing it a lot more in recent years, particularly after my dad died. It wasn't until this last June that I was home and she was playing it, and I said, Mom, tell me why you play that song so often. And she reminded me that my father had come home from the South Pacific on Christmas Eve of 1945. That happens to be my earliest memory. But what I didn't know was that at that time, It's Been a Long, Long Time was the most popular song. It's a, you know, it's a song of anticipation. So for millions of reuniting couples all across the country, that song was the sound of Christmas of 1945.
That's Ralph Whitehead, Jr. of Amherst, Massachusetts. And Ralph, we hope your mom, Marie, is listening today out in Wisconsin. By the way, you can see other memories of Christmas 1945 at hereandnow.org. Just look for the Christmas tree. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Kiss me once, then kiss me twice, then kiss me once again. It's been a long time. Haven't felt like this, my dear. I can't remember.